Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. My name is Tom Tuttle Cunningham, and I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I spoke at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia in 2012, and just last month I spoke at the Think and Grow Rich Summit in Del Mar, California. I'm hosting the Napoleon Hill Foundation Think and Grow Rich event in Toronto on September 14th. You can go to thinkandgrowrichcanada.com for the details. And if you're in the Toronto area and would like a free Think and Grow Rich workshop for your group of 10 or more, go to that same website, thinkandgrowrichcanada.com, for details. Find out more about me. My website is Tom, the number 2, and Tall, T-A-L-L.com. I am excited and very nervous to have as my guest today Dave Linenger, the co-founder of Remax. I met him at the Think and Grow Rich Summit, and his story brought me to tears, but not for what you thought it would be. He's the visionary leader, as I said, of Remax, the co-founder with his wife Gail, a Denver-based global real estate franchise founded in 1973. At the height of the recent recession, he pushed for governmental housing reform policies that would help speed the housing recovery, and many of his recommendations were adopted, and he's widely credited with improving conditions for real estate agents by creating a unique business model combining the maximum commission concept with a host of support services. He's a major advocate of advanced training and education, and he spent much of 2012 recovering from a life-threatening infection that surfaced in late January after multiple surgeries, weeks in intensive care, months in the hospital. He returned to Remax World headquarters in July. When I spoke at the Think and Grow Rich Summit in late April, he had just removed a brace from his right leg to be walking solely with a cane, against any predictions that any doctor would ever have made. He still has limited mobility, but he's working hard at his business, his physiotherapy, and his mental attitude got him through it all. Welcome to the show today, Dave.
Hey, thank you. Nice to be with you today.
Dave, sharing that story will probably touch your story in your book, My Next Step, will touch more people, or as many people, deeply, more deeply than your amazing business success. As you know, Dave, so many people have things happen to them through no fault of their own. You've gone through it twice with your wife, Gail, and then with yourself. And so thank you for sharing a private story with the world, because there's people that are going to need hope. And that story gives them hope. Dave, I noticed you can't do anything, look up your name or anything, without finding out that you passionately love and have a great relationship with your wife, Gail. And you know Think and Grow Rich. Napoleon Hill said the number one mastermind, he talked about Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, was with their wives. And not every spouse, not every husband and wife have that mastermind partnership. Can you talk about how that helped you with just a horrible time you had recently last year, right?
Well, you know, the thing that's kind of interesting is on my drive in today, I was listening to Earl Nightingale talking about Think and Grow Rich. And they were referring to a record, which was the 78, LPs or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that gives you an idea of when this was previously recorded. And of all things, he was talking about the importance of a wife. Now, if you go back and you look at Think and Grow Rich and you understand it was written in 1936 at the end of the recession, there's a lot of things in there that appear to be kind of sexist, but it really isn't. It talks quite a bit about the importance of a wife. In today's day and age, we'd be talking about the importance of a spouse. But that was before Rosie the Riveter and the flood of women going into the workforce during World War II. And so Yes, Think and Grow Rich does discuss the importance of a spouse. It's often your number one support system, the person that believes in you, the person that encourages you. It's nice to have that person as part of your mastermind group.
Yes, and you have that, and you cannot, as I said, if you look anything about you online, it is apparent within 3 sentences that you are passionately involved. Dave, I didn't go through my history. And usually I do my physical history in the introduction. I've had rheumatoid arthritis since I'm 5. I'm turning 50 next month. I've had 4 hips replaced, 4 knees, 2 shoulders, cataracts removed when I was 12. Most of my joints don't move. And I've seen on many doctors' charts myself referred to as a non-compliant patient. Basically means I don't always listen. I'm tough. I don't like to listen always to advice. And you're also, I got a pretty stubborn guy. And so you do what you want, what you feel is best. And like myself, you treat kind of doctors and therapists as part of your team. But you are the CEO of the team. So how much did that stubbornness, competitiveness, I'm going to do it my way, help? Because you were like paralyzed. There was like 35 days you couldn't even move. Nobody ever predicted you'd walk. And so you got to be pretty stubborn to go against all these people telling you this.
Well, you know, the important thing to understand about a medical team is they don't want to overpromise. And so in my situation, I was in intensive care for 8 weeks. I was in and out of a coma for 4 months. And as I started coming out, you know, they had no idea what the level of recovery that I could make. And so when you sit there, your medical team's part of your mastermind or your support group. But I would tell them, totally paralyzed, I'd tell them, get this straight, I'm walking out of this hospital. And they would look at me with sad eyes and they would say, well, you know, Dave, we hope for the best, but we train for the worst. And in the event that you don't have that kind of recovery, we'd like to train you to have quality of life anyway. And that really wasn't what I was wanting to hear, you know. I wanted somebody to say, yeah, we believe in you. But they don't want to overpromise, and they also they don't want to open themselves up for liability. So if they say, well, of course you're going to walk, and you don't, then all of a sudden a patient might sue them and say, well, you said I was going to walk. You must have done something wrong in my hospital stay. And so they don't overpromise. However, thank goodness, I had lots of friends. And I'd be sitting there saying, you guys, I'm going to walk out of here. And they'd say, yeah, I'm sure you're going to. You've made every goal you ever set for yourself. Okay, go for it, Dave. And so they were also part of my support group. Now, and the problem is, if I hadn't figured out and my body hadn't repaired to the point, of course I could have been extremely disappointed. But this hope for the best and train for the worst just didn't set right with my mind.
I know that. And I realize that about doctors. And people should come to realize that they have to give you the statistics and the legal, you know, what they really expect, because they can open themselves up to a lot. They can be the most positive people themselves, but they can't really just tell you you're going to walk when the odds look like you're not going to walk. Dave, one thing that I really admired in your book, you've read Think and Grow Rich 40 times. You have a positive attitude. You went through a lot just to get the business going. And you had a lot of friends visit in the hospital. However, nighttime, you can't move and your friends aren't around. The most positive person in the world can have those thoughts of negativity and you know, talk to people about maybe that is that's all right. You know, it's to be expected, but you need to pull yourself out in the morning. And I would always have tons of friends. Nurses and doctors would say, like, wow, you got a lot of friends. You'd have to, like, limit the number of them that came. And you had the same thing. So during the day, you could stay positive, and they would keep you positive. That night you said that there were some tough times, right?
Well, you know, bravado is fine. At noontime, the windows are open, the curtains are open, the sun's shining, and it's bright and everything, and you got friends surrounding you. But at night, you know, things go thump in the dark. You're laying in bed looking at the clock on the wall, and it's ticking so slow you can't get back to sleep, and that's when the boogeyman comes. You start thinking, okay, well, what happens if I stay paralyzed the rest of my life? How do I provide for myself? Will my spouse still love me? What's it going to be like that I can't go to the toilet, I can't bathe, I can't get into my own wheelchair? And those fears are not just normal, but they're I don't know how the word is, they're overwhelming. And so, you know, occasionally, you know, somebody would come in my room to change an IV. They had to roll me every 2 hours in some fashion because of, you know, getting bed sores from just being paralyzed month after month. And sometimes a very kind nurse would see, you know, dim lights there, and they'd see, you know, the tears in my eyes, and they'd sit and take my hand and say, "What's wrong, Dave?" "Well, what do you think is wrong?"
I didn't like the evening meal.
"No, I'm scared to death." And the kindness and the compassion of a very kind nurse or a technician that would just pull a chair up and sit and just talk and get your mind off of it, and, you know, eventually maybe you go back to sleep. But, you know, everybody has these fears. The strongest in the world is lying to you if they tell you they're never afraid. Fear is a normal reaction to things that are very scary, and it just happens. When I wrote the book, a lot of people have said, "Wow, you really exposed yourself here. You know, this, you're this big titan of business. You're a macho guy that's done all these phenomenal adventure things, and here you're telling how frightened you were." And they said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I wanted to tell the truth. You know, everybody faces the boogeyman. We all have unbelievable fears at times. And to lie and say you don't is nonsense. Courage comes from confidence. Confidence comes from experience. And so you build courage over a long period of time by having built your confidence. And the confidence you built was by surmounting other challenges." When you start talking about your own personal health issues and the knee replacements and the shoulder replacements and the surgeries that you've gone through for your entire life, well, you've been through 5 or 6 surgeries, and they're going to do the 7th or the 10th or the 15th. Those other ones have prepared you, and yeah, it's another surgery. And so the experience of having lived through this multiple times gives you the confidence that, yes, this isn't going to be fun, but this too will pass.
Exactly, exactly. Dave, you made two amazing decisions that I really appreciate. One was you decided not to say, "Why me?" You had something already previously. Gail had an airplane crash just before you were going to get married. Totally on her fault. Why her? And a horrible time and then recovery. But when it happened to you, you didn't say, "Why me?" And the other decision you made that I really love, I love nurses. And I see nurses being treated badly. A guy, you know, reaches over to call a nurse to fluff a pillow or reach something like 2.5 feet away. Like, I go to great odds not to call a nurse unless if I call, they come running because they know they got to come. Because I'm going to do everything I can. And no matter how I feel, I'm treating that nurse well. And yet you're a CEO of a company. You're used to telling people what to do. Go do this, and they do it. But you decided, you decided not to think, "Why me?" And you decided to treat those nurses and therapists and everybody positivity, kindness, niceness, and it's not easy to do when you're going through.
Well, you know, It's kind of interesting. I talked about falling in love with my nurses, and the hospital surrounded me with the most beautiful women you've ever met. Some of them were 22, and some of them were 80 years old. But they were all incredibly beautiful. They had kind and compassion, hearts that are bigger than their chests. And that's the kind of personality of the person who is a caregiver. If they weren't, they would burn out too fast and they'd go away. So I found out that, you know, they're so compassionate. And, you know, when you go to the hospital and you're there for 2 days, you have two or three shifts a day. You may see the same nurse once or twice, and that's it. When you're in a hospital for 7 months with two or three shifts, you get to know every single person that comes into your room. They're there for months and months. You know when they have a spat at home, or they're having marital problems or financial problems, or whether they're discouraged or they don't like the doctor that's working with you. I mean, it is a very close, intimate relationship when you know these people 24/7 for months on end. And so I respected my nurses. My caregivers were important to me. They were always kind. I never had anyone that was ever gruff with me. And so it was really funny. When I started regaining consciousness and my cognitive ability, I told the people at my office, I said, get the writers and get the video people in here. You know, I'm a motivational speaker, and I'm always looking for new material, and this is going to be a heck of a story because I'm walking out of here. And so they actually came in, and they started interviewing my doctors, nurses, therapists, anesthesiologists. And when I was capable of coordinating the writing of the book, months and months later, here I had 200 interviews, some of them an hour long. They'd all been transcribed, and it was amazing to me to read what some of the doctors and nurses said. Now, it's an entire different part of the world than what I had anticipated. But, Tom, one of the things that was really interesting was I had a very lovely young nurse. She must have been 26 or 27. And reading her transcript of how terrified she was when she was told that they had this really big-wig donor to the hospital that was going to be in her direct care, and she thought to herself, oh, my goodness, this big-time businessman, powerful and so on, oh, what is it going to be like? I'm scared to death of this. And right. She was very pleasantly surprised when, as many patients, I was very much a gentleman. I said, please and thank you. And I was very concerned about people other than myself. And then she met my family, and she was thinking, oh, look at these spoiled rich kids. What's this going to be like? And so all of a sudden she found out that my kids were very – I'm sorry, my kids are 45 years yes. old, so they're my right. kids. And so as she found out, they always said please and thank you, and we appreciate you taking care of Dad. And they got out of the way, and they were always as helpful as they could be. And then a week later, my daughter and her husband actually showed up at this nurse's first attempt to run a triathlon. And they had talked to her about it in the hospital, and so they were at the finish line with big signs that said congratulations to her, we're proud of you, that type of thing. And she was thinking, wow, what kind of a family is this?
Exactly, exactly. And that makes so much difference to a nurse to know that she's not going to get that grief from a family. And your family was so amazing. I'm going to ask you a question about them after, because that really touched my heart. But one thing that stood out, you and I are the same. We do not like to ask for help. It was a challenge when I was young. One time a kid in high school, a girl asked my sister, it looks like Tom has a problem with the stairs. And they offered to help. And my sister said, you better not. He wouldn't appreciate it, and he'll go back up and come down by himself to show you that he can do it. But as I got older, I know I love to help people. and I would feel sad if someone needed help and did not ask me. And so this has come to take over a little more than the stubbornness, although my wife will see me try to pick something up off the ground for 4 minutes before I'll even ever ask or consider for help. So she says, I'm still stubborn. But and you even tell a story, you fell, you're naked in your bedroom, and you need to call a guy to get you back in bed, a guy that works for you, who you drink beer with, but you're not usually naked. So how tell me about this learning to accept help, because it's really not easy for stubborn, proud guys like us.
You know, I kind of slipped into it very, very easily because I was unconscious, and as I started to regain consciousness, you know, you don't come out of a coma like in the movies. They click your fingers, you're wide awake, and you're talking away and stuff. That doesn't ordinarily happen. You're coming out of a very thick cloud. Your cognitive reasoning is very limited in my case. I asked my psychiatrist one day, and he was sitting there talking to me, and I said, well, doc, tell me, what's my cognitive reasoning? And he said, well, we've got you about 5 or 6 years old. And I thought about that. But, you know, it was coming back slowly. And so, you know, being paralyzed, I couldn't feed myself. I actually had a feeding tube in me for over 7 months. I couldn't do anything for myself. Thank goodness, you know, they had me heavily sedated with morphine and other very powerful drugs because of the pain. But it just kind of came that I had no choice. The thing's really remarkable is that I was always independent. And the loss of independence is incredibly depressing, if you will. Mm-hmm. But what I discovered was how incredibly kind people are to people who need help. You know, you get in your car and somebody cuts you off and you say a couple of cuss words under your breath and, you know, whatever. That's just... people bump into each other, and they're not thinking, and they just react. When you see somebody struggling that can't open a door, that's in a wheelchair, I mean, there's even bad guys immediately will change personalities, reach up, grab the door, and open it and say, here, let me help you, sir. And when people see people needing help, mankind is incredibly kind. And so, you know, it kind of, I had always opened doors for people as a courtesy. I always helped somebody that looked like they needed help. And I kind of come to accept it. I never got to a point of being angry or frustrated that somebody was offering me assistance. And, of course, you know, after, 15, 16 months now, I'm walking fairly well with the use of a cane. And so I don't need near the help that I did 6 months ago. And so I guess I'm going back to being normal again. I have no resentment to any person ever offering to help me, but it sure makes me conscious of how much other people sometimes need your help. And I was always willing to provide it. Now I understand I am really providing something just way cool.
Exactly, exactly. And you mentioned, I used this in a speech a few weeks ago about using a walker. And people are so kind. I really didn't like using a walker. I had to use one around Christmas. People open the door. They let you in front of the lineup. You know, Christmas can be a long line at the cashier. You're in a walker. Oh, man, come on front. Oh, yeah, I'll help you. And open doors, bring it to your car. I'm like, wow, mankind is amazing. I joke to the audience that during Christmas you should always pull out your walker, whether you need it or not. You're going to get treated really nicely. You're going to get in the front of the line. You're going to get all the parking spots. And it's going to make life a lot easier. Dave, book.
A really funny story. I was in an electric wheelchair, and I had to have a handicap accessible van. They weigh, you know, the wheelchair weighs 400 and some pounds. And I was in a nice restaurant, and I was trying to go into a men's room, and had very heavy doors, and I mean extraordinarily heavy for somebody that hadn't pushed a door open in 7 months, and I got stuck in the doorway. And there's little levers on the bottom sides of your wheelchair that you can push down, and what happens is that disconnects the motor so somebody can kind of push you instead of fighting the engine, if you will. I got disconnected. And so I'm stuck between the door and the door jamb. I have turned off one of these little levers. I don't have the ability, because my arm's paralyzed, to reach down and undo the lever. And I'm stuck. And I'm stuck trying to get into a restroom. And so with my other hand, I managed to call my son on his cell phone. And it's like, help.
Help. Help, I'm stuck. Where are you stuck, between two doors?
Well, you told the story about being naked. When I went home, I was still paralyzed on one arm and both my legs. And they wanted me to have 24-hour nursing, and I said, no, I'm going to work this thing out. I had a hospital bed installed in the master bedroom, and I had my electric chair right beside it. And so it was time to get up at 5 in the morning, and I finally got my legs and lifted them over the side to try to slither down and get my butt into my chair. And I had no strength in my legs, and I just slid down the bed and onto the floor. I'm buck naked. I'm laying there. My wife's in the shower. About 5 minutes later, she comes out, and I said, can I borrow your cell phone? And so she gave me a cell phone because she couldn't pick me up. And so I had to call. We had security people for the household and the next house over. And I called at 5 in the morning, and I said, help. I'm falling, and I can't get up. And so this big guy, it's a good friend of mine. He's worked for me for 15 years. Neither one of us seen each other naked. He unlocks the door, runs through the house, and runs into the bedroom. And he looks at me. I'm sprawled out on the floor. And he says, boss, what do I do? And I said, well, pick my fat butt up and put me in the chair. And he grabs me. And he's about 300 pounds himself. He lifts me up, sits me in the chair. He says, anything else, boss? And we're both looking at each other's eyes. Neither one of us is glancing anyplace else. And I said, nope, that's enough. Thank you. And so you have to laugh at the most embarrassing things that happen to you, but it's an attitude thing. If you don't laugh, you're going to start crying.
Exactly. I used to make fun of that lady in that commercial. I've fallen and I can't get up, but now I'm that lady myself. And it's embarrassing. Yeah, Dave, in your book, you talk about your family. You have 3 kids. What do I remember? 2 boys and a girl?
No, I've got 4. 3 boys and 4. Oldest is a girl.
There you go. See, my memory is going. But your family, so your kids and your wife, they had to make decisions, some of them that could have killed you or left you definitely, no matter how positive you are, paralyzed. And even as I read those, I thought, oh, if I had to make that decision for my dad. And yet they all worked in harmony. There wasn't bickering. There wasn't, no, dad would want this. No, dad would want that. And I've seen that cause problems for doctors, nurses, and families. How did your family work together so well with decisions that could have killed their father, paralyzed him 100% for sure?
One of the things interesting is the reason they have security police at hospitals is not because of bad guys coming into the hospital. It's because of the arguments that break out amongst family members who are fighting over whatever's going to happen to the patient. In my case, I had a great family. They did not have a single argument. One of the most amazing things to the medical staff was that it was all very logical, and they knew me, they knew what I was like, and so every decision, the doctors would come in and say, we have to operate, we can't put it off any longer, and they would say, well, what happens if you don't operate it for another day or two? And they would say, well, he will be dead. And then they would say, well, what's the decision? And then they would,
yeah.
You know, the doctors would say, well, we're actually going to be cutting on his infection that's in the disc of his back, and that we will actually be lifting his spine to a certain degree out of his body, and we will be scraping his spinal nerve. And there is a high probability that even if he lives, he is going to be either a paraplegic or a quadriplegic for the rest of his life. And the question would always be, what if we don't operate? And the answer every time was, he will be dead. And then it was just a very logical thing that the kids would say, or my wife would say, well, there's no decision. We have to do what's medically proper for him. And so it's very logical.
But one time, wasn't there a time when they held off for a day or two and it ended up working out right?
They kept putting off, putting a trach tube in my throat. They knew I did not want one. As a matter of fact, theoretically I was in a coma, but I couldn't speak. I had a ventilator down my throat. I don't remember this at all, but the kids told about it in their interviews, and they were talking about putting a trach in me, in front of me, and the kids noticed that I had tears in my eyes. And they kept saying, no, we're going to put it off until the last possible minute. And as it happened, my recovery was starting to come back just a little bit on my body, and they never had to put the trach in. And so, you know, they put off some of the decisions that were not life-threatening, but there was always a timetable that at some point the decision had to be made.
Right, and what the unison that your family had, to me, it spoke to how well they know their father. And not every father, not every kid knows their father as well as yours knew you. And you're a big titan of business, busy guy, but it's obvious you invested enough time in them and care and your heart and your soul that they all knew what Dad would want, what's best for Dad, and Dad would not want us arguing. And so that speaks to something about you being as a very committed father as well. So I got that out of your family. That was a great job. But I got behind that you did a good job raising them so that they know what's important to Dad and what's the best decision for Dad.
Tom, somehow or another, kids survive their parents. You know, you just figured out they're pretty resilient, and you know, if you get the right circumstances, it works out just fine.
Amen. Thank you so much, Dave. I took a few minutes more, but this is an incredible story. Thank you for sharing it. It takes courage to share it, but you're going to give people who are in those dark moments that you had hope. And sometimes that's all they need to get to the next day. I just recently, last Saturday, had a friend commit suicide. And so when you're in those deep despair, your book is going to help people because you've been there. And regardless how much money you have, you needed something more than that in those times. And so thank you for sharing that story, David. It takes a lot of courage to open your life like that, but it will touch a lot of people. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Tom. You have a wonderful day, and I'll look forward to seeing you again soon.
Amen. Take care, Dave. Thanks so much.